Hey everyone, welcome to the Cuppa and Annotta podcast. If you love to read books, or if you're an author, then this podcast is for you. I'm award-winning and best-selling author, Tina Hogan Grant. Join me and a new guest author on every show. We'll be sharing writing tips, what inspires us to write our story, and answering questions from our listeners. Hey everyone, Tina Hogan Grant here with my Cuppa and Annotta that I like to do on a Monday twice a month. I like to invite authors into my home. We talk about writing, books, life as an author, and whatever comes to mind. And tonight we have Simon Worrell and his wife, Heather Doon McAdam, here tonight. How are you doing this evening, guys?
Good. Just about awake in England. It's 1 o'clock.
This is so weird because
Heather, it's tomorrow morning.
I'm in California. Simon is in England. And then we have Heather on the East Coast, correct?
Yes, I'm in New York.
So we are like in three time zones here.
We are. And
you and Simon are married. You wrote the book together, Starcrossed, which is what we're going to be talking about this evening. So congratulations on your new release. It came out in September, correct?
Yep.
Congratulations. I do have some questions about a married couple writing a book together. We are going to get into that. There it is. Beautiful cover. Before we get into that, either one can answer, but can you just give me a little backdrop to the book, what it's about, without giving anything away?
Take it away, Simon.
I'll go first. So it's a love story set in World War II Paris between a young, beautiful, there she is, Jewish girl called Annette Zellman, who's 20 in the book, 19 actually, I think. And she is from a big, boisterous Jewish family. Went to the Academy of Beaux-Arts art school. She's an artist, writer, and she falls in love with a young French boy who's a poet of some repute called Jean Jaucian. And we refer to Romeo and Juliet, a true Romeo and Juliet story in Hitler's Paris, because like Romeo and Juliet, the Capulets and the Montagues, the parents of this couple are against the marriage. She's Jewish. He's from a very traditional, strict Catholic background. Her parents are not so anti-Catholic as they think she's too young to get married and there's a war on. But he's adamant that their only adored son should not marry a Jewish girl.
Wow. And these are based on true events.
It's a true
story. And the pictures in the books are actual photos of your characters. Heather, can you give me some insight on what inspired this story?
Well, actually, Annette is the posthumous aunt of one of my best friends, who I've known since the late 80s. She married one of my best friends, who I've known since like 1978, and their children, we've known them since they were in diapers and are just a huge part of our lives. In the summer, they come out. I live in the Hamptons. They come to the beach every summer. Her husband, Ron, grew up on Long Island, so he comes home to see his family. And for, you know, the past 30 years, we've been spending the summers on the beach with the kids. And every summer, Laurence will say to me, you know, in her thick Parisian accent, Heather, you must write a book about my aunt. And I say, Laurence, you know, pass the beer. And I don't want to talk about the Holocaust. I'm on the beach. But a couple of years ago, she said her mother had just inherited a box of letters.
Wow.
And art. And the story of her aunt was, before that, it had just been a family story. Now suddenly we had primary source. We had letters, we had poetry, we had art. And it was an extraordinary archive, and that lended itself to tell the story.
Wow, incredible. I mean, what a treasure.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing. What a treasure.
Go ahead. I mean, I was just, before we were getting on, I was just pulling some things out. So, you know, this is a letter that she wrote at the Café de Flore. And we have the date, and we know it's a Sunday. It says dimanche. These are copies of the letters. There's her signature, you know, written to her brother. And, you know, we just have pages and pages and pages of story.
It's fantastic. She was a wonderful, wonderful, funny.
Very funny.
Naughty letter writer.
Yeah.
I mean, the research that you do, what you stumble across, what you come across, it's just got to be amazing. It's just got to be amazing. And as far as Star-Crossed goes, this is Annette and Jean story.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little insight? Heather, you said you'd be able to read a little excerpt that'll
I'll give you a heads up. So, you know, part of the archive are photographs. And so we have these photographs, a little hard to see here in the book, but we have photographs of Annette right here. Oops, sorry.
I got it backwards.
There we go. I've got to go backwards. There we go. Annette holding onto the discus thrower at the Beaux-Arts. And then we have her down here as well. So these are archival photos that the first scene in the book, we use those to describe the scene. And so we looked at them and looked at the energy of these young people. We know a little bit about what was going on. And this is how the book begins. Paris, January 1941. Here is Annette Zelman, just 19. Celebrating her acceptance into the Beaux-Arts, the most famous art school in all of France. She's only been in Paris for a month, and already she has found her niche. Her mane of thick, dark blonde hair gleams in the sunlight, pinned in a fashion all her own, curls akimbo. A headband hauls them back off her face, almost. She is still a teenager. The baby fat has not yet fallen from the cheeks of her face. Her eyes squint in the winter light and crinkle in a full-on smile. It is cold out, but today is a day for photos, a day to celebrate. Annette is starting her first semester at the Beaux-Arts. The announcements have been made. She is going to be an artist.
Wow.
And that scene comes from those photographs. And I think people think, oh, this is like a novel. It's not a novel. But archive comes from many, many different sources. And one of our sources, we do have a rich art and photographic archive, as well as letters to create our scenes.
Incredible. Now, when your aunt, you say it was your aunt?
No, my best friend.
Your best friend, when they asked to write the story, whose idea was it for you both to write the story together? How did that come about?
Well, I'm a Holocaust biographer. This is my third Holocaust book.
Okay.
So Laurence's mother is alive, the younger sister of Annette Zelman. And Michelle is in her 90s, but she does not speak English. And so Simon is often very helpful to me because he's fluent in German and French. Yes. And it's a good reason to keep him around. And it just made a lot of
my writing skills.
He's also a good writer. He was able to do all the, you know, I don't want to write too much about Nazis. So he also did all the Nazi stuff. But we divided up the work, and he did all of the interviews with Michelle. And I can read French, but I'm not fluent. So it was just a natural progression, you know, to bring him on and to do this work together. It's been great.
It sounds fantastic.
Of course, it's been really wonderful.
this is the first book you've written together?
Yeah. We're each other's editors.
We work together all the time. We're our first editors.
Oh, I love that. Do you think you'll write another book together?
I don't know.
I'm writing another book, a new book with someone else now.
Oh, with somebody else. And as far as when the writing, you know, when you're doing the writing, how did that come together with you both writing the book? Did you each set each other tasks, or did you just combine everything that you read? How did that process work?
Heather did the letters of the alphabet A to L, and I did L to Z.
Oh, no, that was easy. Just kidding.
No, it sort of fell out quite naturally. So the last third of the book is Auschwitz, and that's Heather's speciality. And then, you know, she pretty much did Annette's voice for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a lot of this historical heavy lifting about the Nazis and occupied Paris and rationing and all that jazz. And I did most of Jean's stuff, research. And so it kind of fell out quite naturally. And I defy you to open a page of the book and say, oh, Simon wrote that or Heather wrote that. You know,
well, the best writing is mine.
Yeah. No, obviously.
Is that up for debate?
Yeah, no, obviously.
I just say, you know, so I wrote about Auschwitz, but I also, I did, Annette's in three prisons. She's in the depot. She's in Les Tourelles and in Paris. Those are two prisons. And then she's deported to Auschwitz. And one of the things I seem to be very good at is finding, so there's 66 women on the first transport of Jewish women, French Jewish women to Auschwitz. And I was able to find many, many photographs of these girls.
Wow.
Prior to this, we have names, but to actually find, and this is the work of, sorry, I keep turning it the wrong way.
Okay.
Ah, it's sort of anti-intuitive. This, you know, this is, I had four archives that I went into to find these photos. And I just, you know, I did the same thing in my work in 999. And I've got a documentary film coming out too. I really believe in putting names to faces, mm-hmm. to personalize the history, because these girls disappear off the face of the earth. Most of them. Only there's only two known survivors of that transport that Annette was on.
Only two
that we know of for sure.
Oh my goodness. And with Annette's story, she became a political prisoner because of her marriage to Jean. Is this the reason why she became a political? Can you just give me a little background? Of course, you know more than I do, and this just fascinates me. But the Yellow Star.
It's an amazing, you know, I found a memoir in Memorial de la Shoah, which is the archive at the Holocaust Museum in Paris. And of course, we were in Paris during COVID. So a lot of our research was, it took weeks to get into archives and get slots, and everybody was social distancing. And we had a fantastic archivist at Memorial de la Shoah. And I found this memoir. It's very, very small. It's maybe 30 or 40 pages, but it was written by a teenager who was a Gentile, and she was arrested because she was on the street in solidarity with her best friend who was Jewish, and Alice put a yellow star on. And her friend did not get arrested, and Alice did, and she ended up in the depot. And she writes just passionately, you know, the older women, which of course she's like 16. So the older women are like Annette, 19, 20, mm-hmm. right? They're comforting her and they're supportive of her. And she writes about them being taken. Nobody knows where they're going. And she just writes about their experience in a very raw child's perspective of prison, which is just brutal and so true. Like, you know, there's just no flowery language, and she's obviously in deep shock about what's going on. And she's also watching it from the perspective of a Gentile. So she's relatively safe.
The yellow stars were introduced, I think it was early 42, was it?
It was June 42.
What?
June.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So they were introduced and Jews then were mandated, they had to wear a yellow star.
And there was a huge uprising in Paris, which is really, it's quite exciting. I mean, the Parisians had a sort of fantastic way of rebelling. And it was also because they were Parisian, that was also, it was often through fashion and art. And so like one woman put yellow stars on her dog's collar. She ended up in prison. I mean, it was any way of, you know, sticking it to the Nazis. They did it in really creative ways. And the prisons got packed full of Jews and Gentiles. There was one couple, a mother and daughter, who they were going to get their yellow star and they were walking down the street and arrested for not having their yellow star on. One woman went to put an envelope, you know, went to the post box in her nightgown and she was arrested because she didn't have a yellow star on. I mean, it's just ludicrous.
Do you know how many, if any, Holocaust survivors are still living today? Do we know how many?
Tough call. Yeah, it's that's a very, and it's a broad. How are you defining it? Right. You know, are you defining Holocaust survivor as somebody who went to the camps, or a Jewish child who survived? You know, in hiding. Right. So it's, you know, there are people who may be in their 80s who mm-hmm. never went to a camp, who were in hiding, who would be considered a survivor. And there's people who were in Auschwitz in the camps who would be in their 90s. I can tell you that of my other book, 999, of the very first transport to Auschwitz, which was 999 young women, there are three left, and we just lost one 2 weeks ago. And they're all in their late 90s at this point.
And how young were these women when they were taken into
teenagers?
Teenagers.
Yeah. And Annette's transport, Annette's just 20. There's a couple of teenagers in her transport, but most of the women they're in their mid-20s. There's a couple of professionals, scientists who are older in their late 20s. A couple of them have children. They're married. Claudette Bloch, who survives as a scientist, and she works at Sorbonne. Rhea Kagan is a philosopher. You know, it's a very wide range in this particular transport from Paris, the first transport of French.
I think the work that both you do is incredible. The fact that you tell these young ladies' stories, I think it's just wonderful because they need to be told.
They need to be told.
So something like this doesn't happen again. We just cannot forget what happened back then. And I commend both of you for telling these ladies' stories. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. It's just heartbreaking. The research, not just for this book, but all your books. But let's start with Starcrossed. I mean, the research that you two did must have just been a lot.
It was a lot.
A lot. How long did you spend researching for this book?
I suppose it was about a year, was it?
At least, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we were in Paris for 3 months.
Yeah, so the core of the research, you know, our primary source was Michelle Cares, who is Annette's younger kid sister in the book. And it was her memory and stories that were the backbone of the book, if you like. Mm-hmm. And then we had to set all of that in the context of the war, the occupation, the Nazis,
the letters,
that. Yeah. And then, you know, there was all of the different strands and artistic movements. So a lot of research about the Café de Four, where Annette used to go just
this
near.
This is my timeline. One of them. This is December 1940 down into 42. And I just realized I still have it on the wall. You know, you have to keep it straight. And it's very complicated. You know, it's like weaving a tapestry. And part of our research is, you know, most of our work is primary. There's secondary sources through books, but we also, you know, Simon's background is National Geographic. So we did a lot of field work. We drove from Paris to Nancy on the Rue de Liberté that Patton took. We went down to Sanary-sur-Mer and I scuba dive. I did the scuba dive that Jean would have done so I could see what the, you know, see what
Jean, Jean was one of the first people to scuba dive. And in fact, he scuba dived with the young Jean Cocteau.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he wrote an article for the Paris Soir.
What? Jacques Cousteau. Jacques. You said
Jacques Cousteau.
What did I say?
You said Cocteau.
Jacques Cousteau.
So, yeah, and he wrote an article for Paris Soir magazine or newspaper, which Annette was very impressed by this. She thought, you know, what can't my lover do? He's a poet, he's a journalist, he's a writer, and he even dives under the water.
Wow, incredible.
Yeah, so we did a lot of, you know, trained by National Geographic as I was. You know, what they teach you is that they want to see the world through the eyes of the noodle seller on the corner of the street in Hanoi. They want to see what he sees. They want the reader to smell it, feel it, and be inside his world. And so, as Heather said, we tried to replicate some of that by doing, you know, boots on the ground field work. So we went out, as she said, visiting different sites. One of the things we did was when Annette was arrested from the house in the apartment in
Strasbourg,
Boulevard Strasbourg, she was taken to this awful prison called the Depot, which is in the Palais de Justice, the Palace of Justice, which is this huge fortress-like building on the Ile de la Cité. She was taken at night, probably about midnight, sometime like that. And we recreated that journey. I had my car with me, and we drove the streets that she would have taken at that time to get that feeling of, you know, the sound of the cobblestones on the towers and the shadows and the huge, immense fortress-like building that she would have arrived at. And it gives you that tactile, immersive quality that you can't replace.
And you put the reader right in the story.
Put the reader right there, yeah.
That's some fantastic research, it really is. And I'm sorry, can we see the cover one more time for others that are just joining us? I'm talking to Heather and Simon. They wrote the book Starcrossed, and it's a fascinating story if you're just joining us. The pictures on the front, can you explain to why you chose those pictures, the photographs, if you can just give some background for the cover?
This is Jean Josselin.
Okay.
And this is Annette Zelman. This is actually the only photograph that we were able to find of Jean. And, then we have that lovely archive of the Arc de Triomphe and some Nazis.
Oh, boy. <That's insane. laughs> And how about the title?
Nope. Sorry. Oh, yeah.
The title. How did you come up with the title for the book?
Well, that's the Romeo and Juliet reference, Star-Crossed Lovers in Romeo, Shakespeare, okay. And Juliet. So Star-Crossed, a true Romeo and Juliet story in Hitler's Paris. And
I just want to say, you know, so each, we wrote the book in five acts.
Yeah.
Which Romeo and Juliet is in five acts. So each section has, you know, like this is act four.
I love that.
And we have these, and a lot of these are photo montages that were done by the cousin of Annette, Jacques Sierpinski, who is a very fabulous photo montage artist. And this is one of his photo montages. So this is Birkenau with a superimposed letter of Annette written and the train tracks in Birkenau. So we used a number of his, and he's just, yeah. So I thought it was important, since Annette was an artist, mm-hmm. that we include her art in the book. So almost every chapter has a sketch of hers or something of hers. And then we have quotes from Parisian artists and writers. And then we broke it into the acts, the five acts.
Wow, incredible. Now the letters, back to the letters. The book is inspired by the letters that Annette had. Yeah. Now, were these just letters that Annette had written, or are they also letters from Jean, too?
We have very few from Jean. Jean was an only child, and well, I won't spoil it, but there's no archive of his that remains. But this Annette's letters, that's an interesting story, because nearly all of them were written to her adored brother Charles. And Charles was the sort of eccentric intellectual of the family, very funny, mischievous sense of humor, great reader, Nietzsche, and you name it what. But he was arrested in 1941
August.
Yeah, for selling black market goods. He was caught.
Nylons.
He took the train from Paris to Bordeaux selling nylon stockings. And he was nabbed, and he was put into a horrible prison called Fort de la Haye in Bordeaux, which was infamously brutal. And to keep his spirits up, Annette started writing to him two or three times.
Okay.
His mother traveled down every weekend to visit him and bought letters as well. So the majority of these letters, and they have almost secret code, sort of, you know, references to things that they particularly shared. So the majority of these letters are to Charles. And how they survived is extraordinary, because Charles clearly kept them in prison, and then all through the war, and then afterwards, right up to the, you know, 2000.
The day he died.
Yes,
yeah, nobody knew.
Michelle Cares, our source, our witness, didn't know anything about it until Charles died, and his daughter then gave them to Michelle. And boom, there they were.
And Michelle says an extraordinary thing. She says, reading the letters, she feels like she got to know her sister. Because she had been a child, she had been a teenager. She was like 12, and you know, and her sister disappeared when she was 13 or 14 years old, and so she never really knew her sister as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And to read these letters and understand the complications and the love life and how her sister was trying to navigate Paris and the art world. Gave her an insight to her sister that she had never known before. And she's in her 90s when she finally, or 88, I think, when she finally discovers this self, this sister.
Wow. And through your research, I mean, I just can only imagine what you stumble across. I mean, the surprising things that you find. Does anything stick out?
Heather has an amazing story.
Oh, I want to hear it.
Which one?
Yeah, you have to have so many.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of Bella.
Oh, God. All right. So, yeah. So this is, so Jean Rouch, who's a very famous documentary filmmaker, Annette was dating him. She was dating everybody. Very interested in young men. And he was very handsome. And Simon had done an interview with Jean Rouch's widow, and we got permission from her to go into the archive, the Jean Rouch archive at, is it Bibliothèque Nationale?
And I think it was the Bibliothèque Richelieu.
So we get in there, and we have three boxes. We're looking for photographs of Jean Josselin and maybe a photograph with Nanette and Jean, anything, because we only have one photograph that survived of Jean Josselin, and he was a friend of Jean Rouch's. So we are going through box, you know, we're doing, I think we did 1938, yeah, we did 1939, 1940, 1941. Because we know by 1941, Jean Rouch has gone to Africa. So we all know that if we're going to find anything, it's going to be earlier.
And there was nothing. There was pictures of him in skiing holidays and in the woods and hiking.
And with his friends. With Yannick Bellon, who he was having an affair with, who was a friend of Annette's, but we didn't find anything in the last box. And we are, I mean, this is like this gorgeous oak library, you know, stories of books, everybody's silent. And I am in the last box, and I'm, you know, going through the photographs one at a time. And at the very bottom of the box is this photograph right here. Ah, that one.
Oh, wow.
And I look at her and I turn it over and it says, my neighbor on Rue Saint-Jacques, dead after deportation, Bella Lempert.
Oh, wow. And
until that moment, we had no idea. We know that Bella and Annette were friends and then frenemies. And we know, have all the story of Bella. We had no idea that she was a neighbor of Jean Rouge and that she was the connecting point between those two.
What a find. And you finally have a face.
Isn't she great? So she's called the Zazu. She was very hip. Oops, sorry. There we go. Very, very hip chick. Simone de Beauvoir refers to her as the Israelite with ivory skin and ink black hair. She's always laughing with Annette at the Café de Flore. But the moment I saw this, I lost it. I mean, I was sobbing. It was like she was waiting to be discovered. And she's, you know, she is one of the things you discover when you're doing Holocaust research is that when you get into the archives at Yad Vashem, if a family survives, often you'll find notices from survivors asking for information about you know, sisters or cousins or, you know, anybody have any information and addresses. There is nothing on the Lempert family, which means the entire family is wiped out.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So it's, you know, to find this, you know, this archive and to be able to put this face to her name is just, I mean, I want to cry.
The emotions that you just, you know, felt when you did. But, wow. Incredible. Just incredible. When it comes to the research, what challenges did you have to come across? You know, the challenges during the research, something that was difficult or.
Well,
they found almost impossible.
Well, the biggest nut to crack was Jean Josselin, who, though he was quite well known in the 30s, he'd founded a group called the Reverbère, which means street lamps, and they were a sort of Dadaist group that ran a magazine and put on happenings and theater shows. And you'd have thought there'd be quite a lot about him, but there was very little, in fact, and it was hard to find references to him and particularly hard to find photographs of him. That one Heather showed on the cover.
On the cover?
Yeah, that's taken at Annette's family in Limoges after they fled Paris. They went to a farmhouse near Limoges and they took that one surviving photo.
That's it. Yeah,
you can only just see he's on the right.
I love these pictures.
Yeah, they're great.
We searched high and low for pictures of Jean. We couldn't find any except
nothing.
That. So that was a big challenge. I guess the other big challenge was just working from foreign language sources. I had to do a lot of work from German. So the main baddie in the book is the head of the SS in Paris called Theodor Daneker. And the only really major biography was in German. So I had to plow through that, take, you know, material out that I wanted and put it into English and rewrite it, of course. So there was all of that. Heather, what about you?
You know, I'm so used to it being difficult. I have to say, if you're going to be a historian, if you're going to write nonfiction, you have to like puzzles.
Right.
And I love a good puzzle. And I like cryptograms and, you know, I like mysteries. And so it is doing historical archival research is like finding puzzle pieces. And a lot of times you have blanks for quite a while. And then it's like Bella, you go, and sometimes you don't even know it's a blank, right? And you go, right. Wow, look, wow. And that changes the whole narrative. So I love the surprises of it. You know, the hardest part of any of it is the mundane of getting the permissions and getting the legal rights. That stuff will drive you crazy. And it's just,
you know,
and when you want to be in that creative mode and you have to, your editor's like, do you have the rights to this? And you're like, well, I thought I did. I don't know.
We spend our own money, $10,000 on images.
Wow. Now, Star-Crossed, it is historical fiction. It reads like a story, the story of Annette and Jean. You have most of the letters from Annette, missing, of course, the ones from Jean. What about those gaps along the way? You know kind of what's happened with Annette and everything, but the parts that are missing, how do you work around that, and what do you do to incorporate that into the story?
Well, we had a lot of luck with two of the survivors of the transport that Annette was on write about that transport. One of them mentions Annette. And I'm very, very familiar with Auschwitz 1942. So I know this area really well. The memoir was written in only in Hebrew, and I had a translation in French. So I was able to use both of those translations to fill in blanks. And then the other memoir is only in French. And then the Alice Corbel. So all of the holes in there we were able to do. And Simon, you know, we know that Jean Josselin follows Patton. So, you know, Patton is very well documented, that route. And then you go to the weather sources, you know, like if you're, we have, there's so much information out there. You can find the weather pattern on the day. You know what the weather was like, you know what the temperature was like. That's a technique I've used in all of my books to make sure that I have the atmosphere right for what we are writing about.
I'm impressed by your research. It's incredible.
We both love it. And of course, these days with the internet, you know, there's a lot you can do from there, like weather. You can find the weather on any day in 1941.
True.
Precipitation and the wind and how much snow there was, etc.
Poland's harder, but France is quite easy.
Now, I don't want you to give too much away in the book, but does Star-Crossed continue through post-war?
There's a little bit at the end of the survival of Annette's family and Michel.
Okay. Yeah, I was just curious.
Well, right at the end, it comes to their, they start their new life as a family sans Annette in Paris. Because Michel's story is fascinating itself. Once the anti-Jewish pogroms, you have to call them, and deportations really ramped up in Paris, the family decamped to central France in the Free Zone, as it was called, to a city called Limoges, which was Jewish friendly. And they all went except Annette. She said she was going to follow and she'd just look after the apartment and sort a few things out, and then she'd follow. And of course, that was her fatal error, you could say. She never went because she immediately moved in with her lover, Jean, and lived in his studio. And if she hadn't done that, if she'd gone with the family, she would have survived. And so the rest of the family was in Limoges, and then the Nazis invaded the Free Zone, and it was no longer safe there. And they all separated. And Annette's parents took refuge in a farmer's attic barn with six other Jewish families or couples.
Well, their own family, too. Yeah. And Michelle, they sent her with children to Switzerland. And she ended up in Switzerland for the last year of the war.
Yeah. And the brothers got over the Pyrenees. One went to the States, one went to England. And then after the war, immediately they're all reunited. And one of the most moving sections in the book is that, 1945, it's not after the war. But as the camps empty out of their survivors, they're all brought to Paris, and they put them up, ironically, at the most luxurious hotel, one of in Paris, called the Letitia, Hotel Letitia. And so you had this picture of this incredibly luxurious hotel full of people in their striped outfits, you know, barely alive, skeletal remains of human beings, and photos everywhere, and relatives clamoring. Every day, relatives would go. And every day, Michelle went with her mother, Kayla, to the Hotel Letitia to wait for Annette, she hoped.
And, you know, there's a lot of documentation of this. So we have some of those stories of people who do find, you know, like there's a young woman who they read names on the radio and she hears her father's name read. And, and she's a child. She's been in hiding and she races down to Hotel Letitia and discovers that her father is alive.
Famous people like Simone Weil, who became a very famous civil rights activist after the war.
Right. Yeah, everybody was there. Yeah.
And Juliet Greco, the singer, her sister, I think.
Just incredible. I do want to just touch briefly too on your other works because it's just fascinating your star cross, but you mentioned it a little bit earlier, but your book 99. International bestseller and was made into a documentary film,
yeah,
which I and you produced and directed.
I know, I'm crazy.
You're wearing many hats, my dear.
We just had our world premiere last Tuesday, and we are screening at the New York Jewish Film Festival. We'll be in Miami. We're just starting that, and you know, I mean, talk about archival research. When you write a book, all you have to do is describe and then, you know, you find the archive. But in film, everything has to be visual. You can't just go, oh, and this, it looked like this. You have to go, here it is. Yeah. So it was much, much harder. And I would love to show actually before we, you know, I'd love to show some of the art to you. And I see somebody just said, what are you inspired by? And I will say, I'm inspired to find lost girls of the Holocaust, and it is you know, these young women who have disappeared. They you know, we call my film 999 the Forgotten Girls.
Mm-hmm.
But young women, especially in the 40s, but even today, were not important. And teenagers were uneducated. They didn't have social value. And so they've pretty much been written off by history. And mm-hmm. so my work is really focused on 1942 Auschwitz-Birkenau, which nobody's actually written and done research on. And I want to write these women into history, these girls into history. That's my... And finding their faces and sticking their names to these faces, so you
putting this puzzle together, puzzle together.
Then you can't push it back. And you know, the film, and in the book, I have an incredible archive of photos. You know, you see how young they were. I mean, I had 16-year-olds, 15-year-olds going to Auschwitz who survived 3 years in the camps. That's longer than any Jewish man.
Just incredible.
Period. Eli Wiesel showed up. He was there 6 months.
These women had to have bonded together.
They did. And I call it sorority. It's a sorority of sisterhood. And the same is true of Annette. The last known sighting of Annette, she's taking water from somebody who was on the transport. They're bringing water to one of their friends who's ill. And Annette is the big sister. She's taking care of these girls who are sick. That were on that transport together. And you just know, like, this is who she is. They were just amazing young women in extraordinary circumstances that showed up for each other, you know, and did everything they could to help each other survive. And in almost impossible circumstances.
Just incredible. There's a few questions up here I want to put up. One was from B. Of course, it's gone. Oh, here it is. This is from B. She's asking, will you be writing about more survivors that were with Annette?
No. There's only two, and they both have books out, and they are copywritten. And I've pretty much covered it with Annette.
Okay. Yeah. And Heather, most of your books have been about the women of the Holocaust in captivity. Will you be writing more books?
Yep.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Can you give us any insights?
Actually, right now, I mean, Simon has a much more interesting Holocaust story he's working on. I'm hoping to phase out of Holocaust right now. And so I'm not talking about my new project, but Simon could talk about his.
Okay, and Simon, let's do it.
I will hold up some images of the network.
So I'm doing a book about a lost Rembrandt painting, for which, of course, I'm reading Simon Sharma's amazing book, Rembrandt's Eyes. Look at that. That's a big tome.
That is a big one.
Yeah, so it's called The Lost Rembrandt, A True Story of Art, Espionage and Love in World War II Paris. It's about a Rembrandt painting that belonged to a young Jewish woman in Berlin called Anna Block, and it ended up in the States because she sent it out of Germany as the Nazis began to come to power to safeguard it. And so, and behind this Rembrandt little panel is a just amazing story of the Nazis, Berlin, World War II, and Anna Block, extraordinary woman, becomes a member of the resistance during the war and risks her life multiple times. And so that's that. It's a sort of a bit like The Red Violin, the film, but this is a true story. So it's a sort of biography of this little Rembrandt painting through time. Starting with I was just now in Lithuania because the panel was painted on a piece of Baltic oak, which came from Lithuania, we know. In 1617, a tree was cut down in Lithuania. And so I went there and I followed the route of the river where the oak logs were rafted down. So that's another bit of field work and research.
I love the research. Yeah. Back to 999 real quick. The documentary film, where can we see that? If we want to go see it,
we're just launching. If you want to, you can go to 999themovie.com and join the newsletter. And that's where I make announcements. Right now we're starting on film festivals. And we're just talking to a distributor about theatrical releases for New York and LA, and then we'll expand. So it's all it's not like books; it's different, right. You know. But that's what we're starting at right now.
Well, I'll definitely keep an eye out for it. I'm in LA, so hey,
yeah.
Well, close to LA.
I'm going to show one last. So this is.
Sure, go ahead.
This is one of Annette's pieces, and it shows you how funny she was. I'm having trouble doing it. So this is an envelope, and on it she says, "Absence is the mother of all vices." The poet Jean Josselin at his writing desk. Not. He's not there. Right. And that's Annette, right? Yeah.
She was hilarious.
She's very funny. But, you know, I will also say is that a lot of her doodles, so she used to decorate her envelopes coming out of prison in the depot in Les Tourelles. And a lot of them are very political. So she has these little scribbles and she's saying things against Marcel Petain and Cocteau, who was a collaborationist. And she's, you know, she knows. How Jews are being treated by the upper crust in Paris. But of course the envelopes make it out because they just look like crazy little doodles.
I love what you find out about these amazing people. I really do. Simon, another book that you wrote is about your mother.
Yeah, it's called The Very White of Love. And it's based on my mother's story during the war. She was engaged to a very handsome young writer. He was Robert Graves' nephew, the poet Robert Graves. He was at Oxford University. They fell madly in love. And then he went off to the war. And I inherited a box of letters also from her from him and letters of his, of hers to him, which came back to her. And it tells that story. It novelizes that story.
Sounds incredible. And my grandmother, I always wanted to tell my grandmother's story. She was German and fell in love with an English soldier. And he went back to England, but she had a baby by him, my Auntie Nikki. And she actually traveled across Europe to go find this English soldier that bared her a child. And she did find him. But he died soon after they were married of post-war injuries. Mm-hmm. And then she met my father and married him. But she had an incredible story traveling across Europe.
Wow.
So it's something maybe one day I'd love to tell.
One day, yeah.
One day. There's so many fascinating stories that we all want to tell. Mm. We really do. You two are just an amazing couple. And the work that you do is priceless. And the stories that you tell, we all need to read them. We really do. And on behalf of all the women that you are telling their stories, thank you. They need to be told, like I said earlier in our chat, they really need to be told and never, never forgotten. And the work you do is just fantastic. So,
thank you so much. And thank you, everybody. I see all these amazing comments in the side.
Yes. Now, I've been totally ignoring my readers because I've just been so engrossed in your stories. But I will pop a couple of these comments up. B is here. She says, sounds amazing. There's a question here from Karen says, loves it. And she wants to know, does it take you a long time to get all of your facts together?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then Darlene said, I'm going to pop a few. I commend you on the work that you do.
Thank you, Darlene.
Let's see. Tina says, such an incredible story. I can't wait to read it.
Copies available.
Elaine says, I love these stories. Okay, Tina has a question for you. What authors are you inspired by?
Good question.
I find Simon Worrell's very inspirational.
I'm sorry, who?
Yeah. Simon Worrell.
Yeah, I'm inspired by Heather Dune McAdam. no, it's a very, very good question. Inspired by directly these days.
I mean, I Ilyan Wu, who just wrote Master Slave Husband Wife, she's a dear friend of ours. She always says that our work inspires her. But I tell you, I mean, it's an amazing book if you haven't read it. And it was just named one of the top 10 books of the year by the New York Times. And she's inspired by us. You know, she's now inspiring me. It's a beautiful book, beautifully researched, beautifully written. We both read a lot. Mm-hmm. And you know, we love to read. So anytime I find somebody who... I'm not an easy reader because I'm looking for really great language and interesting facts. Simon likes to read novels more than
So I'm not directly inspired in my work, which is nonfiction, because in my downtime I like to read fiction. I read a lot of crime fiction, mysteries. So there's no direct inspiration of, you know, there's many authors I have been inspired by, from Hemingway to Faulkner to you name it, who great non-fiction writer. Bruce Chatwin was British, who's a great
but we writer. Loved Carl Gnosgaard. I mean, we both read his entire, all five books My Struggle.
It's a memoir.
Norwegian writer. He can write about a toilet seat and you'd be fascinated.
There's a great Polish writer, journalist, dead now, called Richard Kapuściński, who was a correspondent in Africa. Fantastic sense of, you know, that thing of being on the ground and smelling it and feeling it. So, yeah.
Incredible. Great choices there. We are coming up to the top of the hour. I mean, I could listen to you two for another hour. I mean, your stories are just swallow me up here. But we do have a giveaway, and I want to thank you for that. Can you let our readers know what you're giving away?
We're giving away a copy of Starcrossed.
Oh, and it'll be signed by one of you, I think.
It'll be signed. It's already been signed by Simon.
Oh, okay.
He left. Okay. He signed a bunch of books, and I will sign it personally to you, to whomever you want, if you want it for Christmas. Make sure I can get
it. Is it a competition? Do they win it?
Yes. What? Now, you have two choices here as far as the giveaway goes. Because there's two of you, you can scroll down and pick a name right now, or I can pick a name for you after the live. It's entirely up to you.
Oh, it seems a bit unfair.
I'd rather you do a random pick. Thanks.
You want me to do it for you after the live?
Yeah.
Okay, I would do that, and I'll pick a winner for you. And I will tag Simon. I believe you're in my group, and I can message you to and email you the winner. Are they able to reach out to you and give you their address?
Yes.
Can they message you or email you? Which would you like?
Email or I'm on your group as well. So
okay, you are?
Yeah,
okay.
However it works best.
Well, thank you so much for that. That's very generous of you. And I'm doing my regular giveaway that I do on every chat, and it is a $5 Amazon gift card. And all of you here know how this works. You need to go to my author page and share this video, share it in your favorite group, share it on your favorite platforms, but tag me so I know that you shared it, and you will be entered in the $5 Amazon gift card. That way we get these wonderful authors out there spreading the word.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here this evening. It's been an incredible chat, and I'm going to hand it over to you for a last few minutes. Words.
Last few words?
Last few words. You can say the last few words of the chat.
Uh-oh. What do you want to say, Simon?
Well, it was an amazing journey for both of us, it's fair to say. It was a very moving story. We learned a huge amount. I learned a huge amount about Paris and the war, rationing, food. And it was just wonderful to live with these two characters for all that time we did the work.
When we finished the book, I remember saying to Simon about a week later, I felt I just missed Annette. Mm. You spend every day with somebody for a year or two and their voices are in your head and you feel their spirit. And and there's times when I just really miss her.
You miss them. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember Michelle saying to me, I think you two would have gotten along. We were both rebels, troublemakers. And I thought that was a really great compliment.
Last question. Do you think there'll be a documentary on Starcross?
We hope it's going to be a Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Who knows?
Yeah.
I'm going to cross my fingers for that one.
Every author hopes that.
Of course we do. We do. But thank you so much. It's been amazing.
Hanukkah, pray for peace, please.
Definitely. Good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us. And I will be in the group in a little bit to announce the winners. Good night, everybody. Good night.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us. And I will see you next time on the Cuppa and Another podcast, when I'll be chatting with another author. Good night, everyone.